Sam turned to Bywater, and so came back up the hill. As day was ending once more, he went on, and there was a yellow light and fire within, and the evening meal was ready, and he was expected. And Rose drew him in and set him in his chair and put little Eleanor upon his lap. He drew a deep breath. "Well, I'm back," he said. "Well, I'm back." With those simple and yet deeply meaningful words, in September of 1948, John Ronald Reuel Tolkien penned Conclusion to The Lord of the Rings. After a decade of hours stolen late into the night, after several thousand pages of drafts and many, many revisions, the story was told. All that remained was to make the last corrections and produce the final typescripts of a massive manuscript, which Tolkien, lacking money, had to do himself with the two-finger method. Over a half million words. That task would take another year of work. In October of 1949, it was accomplished. Tolkien had finished his masterwork. The Lord of the Rings had, of course, started as a sequel to a children's story about the adventures of one Mr. Bilbo Baggins. His publisher had requested another Hobbit story, and upon that modest task, encouraged by the success of his first Hobbit book, Tolkien had embarked in December of 1937 with the recounting of a long-awaited party. But as his imaginative efforts took form in 1938 and 1939, Tolkien came to realize that this new Hobbit story was not simply a sequel to The Hobbit, but the continuation and imaginative completion of a much deeper and vaster undertaking, a charge that had been his fascination and burden for his entire adult life, beginning on the threshold of the Great War in 1915, when he first had answered a summons to the shores of Faerie. Fully exploring, discovering, and recording the story of the Lord of the Rings had been a most difficult journey for Tolkien. At a few premature junctions in the story's early progress, he had thought the end might be close in sight, only to find imagination presenting yet further unseen vistas of characters and events, and a growing series of complexly interwoven plots, like Niggle's painting of the great tree, told in the story, Leaf by Niggle, gifted to Tolkien at the beginning of his journey. The picture just kept growing, and to its edges, older things kept being accumulated. And beyond the canvas, there opened a vista of still more distant mountains. And like Niggle's picture, Tolkien discovered his vision had taken life. It was real. It was alive. For several long periods during this decade of struggle with The Lord of the Rings, work ceased completely. For months he felt absolutely dry of any inspiration for The Ring, as he wrote. Several times he despaired of ever finishing. But at the end of 1949, it was finished. But of course, now there was another problem, another problematic task, publishing his work. The Lord of the Rings was a single book of nearly unprecedented size, an indefinable genre. In print, it would fill over 1,200 pages. And crucially, in Tolkien's conception of his work, The Lord of the Rings was only the last half of an interdependent creative revelation. He felt that it simply could not be understood without the first half, the still protein mass of manuscripts he called the Silmarillion. At the very inception of his work on The Lord of the Rings in December of 1937, After his partial drafts of the Silmarillion were rejected as unsuitable for publication, he had written to Stanley Unwin, his publisher, quote, "I think it is plain that a sequel or successor to The Hobbit is called for. I promise to give this thought and attention. But I am sure you will sympathize when I say that the construction of elaborate and consistent mythology and two elven languages rather occupies the mind. And the Silmarils are in my heart." And again in 1938, he explained, speaking of his efforts now started to write a new Hobbit story, "My mind on the story side is really preoccupied with the pure fairy stories or mythologies of the Silmarillion, into which even Mr. Baggins got dragged against my original will. And I do not think I shall be able to move much outside it, unless it, the Silmarillion, is finished and perhaps published." Now, with The Lord of the Rings completed in early 1950, he again wrote Stanley Unwin, his publisher, quote, "The Silmarillion probably spoiled everything that even remotely approached fairy, which I have tried to write since. Its shadow was deep on the latter parts of The Hobbit. It has captured The Lord of the Rings, so that that has become simply its continuation and completion, requiring the Silmarillion to be fully intelligible. Ridiculous and tiresome as you may think me, I want to publish them both. The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings, in conjunction or connection. I want to. It would be wiser to say, I should like to do so. Since a little packet of, say, a million words is not very likely to see the light, even if paper were available at will. At the same time, that is what I should like. Or I will let it all be. I cannot contemplate any drastic rewriting or compression. Of course, being a writer, I should like to see my words printed. But there they are. For me, the chief thing is that I feel that the whole matter is now exercised and rides me no more. The matter is now exercised. The creative diamond that had burned in Tolkien's soul since 1915 had been released. It had been given form and voice. Of course, the publication of both the Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings was indeed impossible. Stanley and his son Rainer Unwin understood this and were forced to reject Tolkien's ultimatum to publish both or nothing. Publication of both works was impossible not only for practical reasons of combined length, complexity, and indefinable literary genre, and also in the post-war years in England, the shortage and expense of paper. It was completely impossible because the Silmarillion was not an extant work, compiled, coordinated, and condensed in any form remotely ready for publication. Though within Tolkien's creative imagination, the Silmarillion stood as an integral whole with The Lord of the Rings, it was only within his imaginative experience that it was whole. In physical fact, it comprised many stacks of unfinished and often fragmentary manuscripts. By 1952, Tolkien had accepted the reality of his situation. In that year, Rainer Unwin reached out to him again. Here I should add a footnote. Remember when The Hobbit manuscript was sent to Stanley Unwin, the publisher? He had given it to his 10-year-old son, Rainer, to write a book report. And Rainer had approved of the book and suggested his father publish it. This Rainer was now in his 20s and was an executive of his father's publishing firm. And Tolkien always had a soft and dear spot in his heart for Rayner. He considered him a friend throughout his life, perhaps starting with that first favorable book report in 1937. So Rayner was disappointed that Tolkien had refused to let them just publish The Lord of the Rings, and Tolkien had stewed in his juices for a couple of years about this issue. Finally, it did become apparent to him that it simply was not going to happen. And so Rayner sent him a note and reached out again that year, warmly inquiring about The Lord of the Rings. At this point, Tolkien gratefully replied, quote, "As for The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion, they are where they were, the one finished and the other still unfinished, and both gathering dust. But I have rather modified my views. Better something than nothing. Although to me all are one, and The Lord of the Rings would be better far and eased as part of the whole, I would gladly consider the publication of any part of this stuff." Well, Rayner was given the completed manuscript of The Lord of the Rings to read. He considered it a work of genius. And he wrote to his father, Stanley, saying just that, but that attempting to publish it might cost the firm a loss of at least £1,000. It was unlike anything else, enormous in size, costly to print, and it might not sell at all. Stanley replied to his son that if Rayner thought it was a work of genius, then he should risk losing £1,000. And so he did. On July 29th of 1954, the first volume of The Lord of the Rings was printed in a run of 3,000 copies. And as they say, the rest is history. Or as Tolkien might remind us, history is only part of a much, much greater story. After publication of The Lord of the Rings, and up until the end of his life in 1973, Tolkien struggled to bring some final comprehensive form to the manuscripts he called The Silmarillion. But it could not be done. As Christopher Tolkien, his son, commented, the vision that had evoked the myths was now too distant. Many of the texts of The Silmarillion had been written over 30 years before, and Tolkien could not authentically return to their voice, nor could he revision them. They existed as they were, as givens, as gifts. And Tolkien's experience in the realm of faerie was fading. There were paths to which he discovered he could not return. So, why was this joint publication of The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings so important to Tolkien? So important that at one point he was resigned to publish neither if he could not publish both together. The answer to that question is the crux of understanding the imaginative journey of Tolkien, the crux to understanding the man in context, other than simply as author of one amazing work of fantasy titled The Lord of the Rings. For over a half century, millions of readers have enjoyed The Lord of the Rings without any knowledge of the other writings of Tolkien, the writings collectively called The Silmarillion. Why did Tolkien think it required The Silmarillion to be fully intelligible? When after his father's death, Christopher Tolkien lovingly worked to fulfill his father's dream and bring a coherent edition of some portion of the writings known as The Silmarillion to print, the book was a literary failure. Very few of Tolkien's many fans could make any sense of it, and I suspect fewer still read it cover to cover. Christopher Tolkien summarized the negative responses he received to publication of The Silmarillion by quoting a letter complaining to him that, quote, it read like the Old Testament, unquote. The Silmarilling was simply not what readers had expected. It was most certainly difficult reading, and only a very few found it worth that difficult effort. So, to repeat the question, why was this joint publication of the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings so important to Tolkien? Perhaps I can start the answer by quoting the words of Sam, spoken in Cirith Ungol. As Frodo and Sam passed into Shelob's lair toward the dark heart of Mordor. So as they were in Cirith Ungol, as Frodo and Sam passed into Shelob's lair toward the dark heart, in the terrible darkness of that passage, Frodo had remembered the small vessel of light given to him by Galadriel in Lothlorien. And he had pulled that vessel out, and by its light, they had been guided and perhaps saved in that tunnel. Sam speaks. The brave things in the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo, adventures, as I used to call them. I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really mattered. I wonder what sort of a tale we've fallen into. Beren now, he never thought he was going to get the Silmaril from the Iron Crown. And yet he did. And that was a worse place and a blacker danger than ours. And the Silmaril went on and came to Eärendil. And why, sir? I never thought of that before. We've got it. You've got some of the light of it in the star glass that the lady gave you. Why? To think of it. We're in the same tale still. It's going on. Don't the great tales never cease? No. They never end as tales, said Frodo. But the people in them come and go when their parts ended. In seeking to probe the depths of this passage, I remind you of Tolkien's words I quoted a minute ago. The Silmaril are in my heart. And then, my mind is really preoccupied with the pure fairy stories of the Silmarillion. And I do not think I shall be able to move much outside it unless I finish it. The Silmaril were in his heart. Pure fairy stories, the gifts he had received over several decades, the tales of the Silmarillion preoccupied his mind. And I remind you of a history drawn from those tales he had received as a gift, as a given. It was a great force of uncreated darkness in spider form, named Ungoliant, who had poisoned the first lights of creation in Valinor and helped Morgoth steal the Silmaril, the gems of elven light. Shelob, the spider Frodo and Sam now faced in the cave of Cirith Ungol, was Ungoliant's progeny. It was Beren, as Sam relates, who had cut the light of the stolen Silmaril free from the iron crown of the great Archon, Morgoth, the great Demiurge. And lastly, I mention a strange fact of our own time and history. It is the name Beren that Tolkien had engraved upon his own tombstone. To put the puzzle together, we need to understand Tolkien, not just as an author, a literary figure, but in the context of his life experience. As a philologist, as a scholar, as an investigator, an explorer of the perilous realm, the place of experience he called Faerie. Verlyn Flieger, one of the foremost of Tolkien scholars, writes in her book, Splintered Light, and I quote, C.S. Lewis comments that Tolkien had been inside language. This was no figure of speech, but the literal truth. He had gone inside words, perceived through their lenses, and seen the world they had the power to create. Others besides Lewis, who knew Tolkien, came to much the same conclusion. Simone de Ardenne, one of Tolkien's Oxford students and herself a philologist, found another way of putting it. Mademoiselle de Ardenne recalled saying to him once, apropos his work, "You broke the veil, didn't you? And passed through. You broke the veil, didn't you? And passed through." She adds that he readily admitted that he had done so. Now, to those who live outside the veil, including most particularly the vast majority of us who are unaware that there might be a veil hiding deeper realities in life, such words seem pure nonsense. To Tolkien, they were not nonsense. Remember Tolkien's words, written to C.S. Lewis in 1931 as Tolkien's struggle to explain himself and his vision of humankind and his understanding of word and story and myth. In his poem Mythopoeia, addressed from Philomythos to Misomythos, lover of myth, to his friend C.S. Lewis, hater of myth, he had said, We humans are free captives, undermining shadowy bars, digging the foreknown from experience, and panning the vein of spirit out of sense. Those words have echoed in my mind for the last week since I spoke them at the last lecture. Free captives, undermining shadowy bars. You know, there are traditions in the West that have seen humankind that way. Free, but imprisoned. Captive. Captive of what? Some have called him an archon, a demiurge. Tolkien called it the great artifact. The concept of life as unidimensional, as contained by the sensory perception. Tolkien knew something else. Free captives, undermining shadowy bars. We are surrounded by bars. We are attempting to undermine them. Undermine them to find the foreknown from experience. The foreknown. And this is another important concept one must understand about Tolkien. There was a foreknown. known. There was something before within us known. And we were panning it, mining it, digging it from our living experience. We were panning a vein of spirit out of sense. Panning spirit out of sensate experience of this world. It's a radical vision. It's a strange vision. It's a uncommon vision. It's not a consensus vision. In fact, it attacks the consensus. He went on, the heart of man is not composed of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise, and still recalls him. Though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost, nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet he is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned. Okay, one might say that Tolkien had pierced the veil. But truer to his own terminology, I would use the words found the road and pursued the path into the realm of faery. And what was this faery? Well, here, let Tolkien speak again. What is this faery? It reposes in a view that the normal world, tangible, visible, audible, is only an appearance. Behind it is a reservoir of power which is manifest in these forms. If we can drive a well down to this reservoir, we shall tap a power that can not only change the visible forms of things already existent, but spout up with a boundless wealth forms of things never before known, potential, but unrealized. As I related in an earlier lecture, I was asked once if I thought Tolkien was crazy. My answer was no. I've also been asked in conversations about these things if I thought Tolkien was a mystic. Well, my answer to that is also no. And I must say that the term mystic has always rubbed me wrong. When people say mystic, one has the image of this angelic face looking up with hands clasped in prayerful posture before the face and a mist slowly descending. In those terms, no, Tolkien was not a mystic. In fact, very few mystics were. He was not a mystic. And he was not a prophet. And though certainly an author of great power, he was not simply a literary artist. He was a scholar, a philologist, an explorer, and lover of word. He was an exceptional and rational man caught in one of the most extraordinary of human experiences. He attempted to understand the experience, explain the experience, and most importantly, reveal the experience. Tolkien knew that other men had existed who had shared his experience of faery, though they may have called it by different names, the winding road of imagination that led to a truth and a reality, a fact that was not their own creation, nor ever possession. An objective fact before subjectivity of their vision. With the power of this knowledge, this foreknown dug from his own experience, he approached the history of language and its early mythic literature. And here we come to a hard part. And I've struggled long and hard trying to figure out exactly how to express some of these things because they're complex concepts. I want to talk for a minute about Tolkien as hermeneutic. Tolkien and hermeneutics. The word hermeneutics refers to the art of interpretation, the art of translating one tongue to another, or of translating meaning from text. Tolkien, as scholar, as philologist, was deeply involved in a kind of hermeneutics. He approached the old texts of Anglo-Saxon, of Norse, of Middle English, and attempted to translate the experience of the authors, the writers, the visionaries of those days into terms of modern English, to understand their word and the meaning of their word. Of course, this was a hermeneutic process, a process of interpretation. But Tolkien brought to his hermeneutics a very different kind of understanding, something quite alien to common philological process. And that goes to the core of understanding what the ancient authors had been doing. Tolkien perceived that some of these early voices, such as the voice of the author of Beowulf, to whom he was deeply affinitized, that some of these ancient authors had shared his imaginative experience. Though they call it fairy or not, they had sensed a story which they knew to be objective and real. And they had themselves been hermeneutes, translators of an experience into word. It's a vertical axis in the hermeneutic. There is, of course, an horizontal axis, an historical axis, a literary axis in the interpretation. Interpreting word from language to language and conveying across that breadth of difference and time, true meaning, intact meaning. But there's also a vertical axis of the hermeneutic. What of the visionary? What of the person who really does go into this place of fairy and have an imaginative experience, see, vision, envision, a reality that they perceive as objective, as real, as independent of their own conceiving creative self. They also are hermeneutes, bringing back from experience a word. They are translators. The word hermeneutic itself has a history, and of course, Tolkien would take interest in that. The word comes from Hermes, the Greek god. It comes from an astronomical fact, as well, you know. There are five classic visible planets. The one that we understand now to orbit closest to the sun, we call Mercury, which of course was the Latin name of Hermes. I have, over the course of my life, taken great interest in the movements of the planets and stars as I visually perceive them. And I have, for 3 decades, attempted to visually see the planet Mercury. The problem is the little thing is a very dim light. It travels close to the sun. It's never more than a few degrees off of the horizon at the time the sun is setting. It flits back and forth in the twilight between dark and light. And due to the haze and the light pollution of our modern age, it is very difficult to spy. Well, this nature of Hermes, of Mercury, was known to ancients. And it was indeed associated with the image of Hermes, who was, you will remember, the messenger of the gods. It was Hermes who came from the dark and light realms, who was the intermediary of the message, of the communication of peoples and of divine and human. So the hermeneutic art, historically, in its philological history, had relationship to this interpretation of the divine voice to the human tongue. And Tolkien was a participant in that type of hermeneutic, that type of translation of experience, of vision, to word, to story. In his lecture on fairy stories, Tolkien had noted that the realm of fairy is indescribable, but not imperceptible. Indescribable, but not imperceptible. He had sensed it. He had seen it. He had perceived it. To describe it, well, that was beyond him. What he could do, though, is interpret it. In the hermeneutic task, there is that, the interpretation. Bringing from vision and finding form in word, in story, in myth. And this is classic, because, you see, there are some perceptions, some experiences that only can be conveyed in tongue and time of human in the form of myth, in the form of story, of the relationships of story. Tolkien was a philologist. He was a scholar. He was a writer, an author. He had faced three tasks with regard to his own life. The first task, well, he had to listen to vision, to understand his experience, why he had been called, why he had received the Fey Star that led him down that road to the land of Faerie. Well, it was a gift, deserved or undeserved, called or uncalled, it was given. And he had to understand that gift. And I assure you that any human who faces such a gift knows it also a curse and a burden of great weight, a burden difficult to carry, and a burden which one must never claim as his own possession. He had to understand. And as scholar, as hermeneut, interpreter, as philologist, he had to make some attempt to explain, to grant understanding of this peculiar experience. As he said in a letter written late in life, I am my own experimental animal in these things. I have my experience, and it is the study of that experience that has to some degree animated my writings. He attempted to explain his perception of the poet Beowulf, not as the creator of an ancient document of sociological interest alone, but to reveal the poet who had built a great tower, a tower from which he could behold the sea, through which he could pierce the veil, through which he had found a realm very similar to that realm which Tolkien called fairy. So he was a scholar. He had to understand. He had to explain. But ultimately, as hermeneut, he had to do something else. He had to reveal. He had to reveal what he had experienced. It was indescribable. Translation was demanded of him. That translation was his literary work, his literary task. Why was the Silmarillion important? It was in his heart. it was the pure fairy that he had encountered in the intense fire of the beginnings of his journey. And he knew it to be true. He knew it to be real. He knew that it demanded of him revelation. But it had come chaotic. It had come in pieces. It had demanded form of expression. Was it to be told in prose? Or in form of ancient tongue of bard, alliterative verse? Or in form of rhyme? How could its unique power be conveyed in tongue and time of Tolkien? So he struggled. He struggled greatly.
Though he labored for the last 20-plus years of his life, he could not bring it to form. The gift that had been given when he was in his 20s and 30s and 40s, he could not again reform by will in his 50s. It was not his to work it to his desire and means. Only could it be touched with authenticity, the authenticity of primary vision. And he found, apparently and admittedly, in those later years of his life, that he couldn't do it. As Sam had said, "Well, I'm back." In 1950, an important cycle of vision in Tolkien's life really had drawn to a close. In 1964, when Tolkien was 72 years of age, he was asked to write a preface for a new edition of a classic fairy story, The Golden Key, written by George MacDonald, a 19th century Scottish author, poet, and Christian minister. Tolkien remembered the story, first published in 1867, fondly from his own youthful reading, and agreed to attempt to write a preface. But, as he said of the effort once initiated, "I found that a highly selective memory had retained only a few impressions of things that moved me, and rereading MacDonald critically filled me with distaste." What he saw in The Golden Key upon rereading after so many decades was a type of moral allegory masquerading as a fairy story, a genre of literature he profoundly disliked and had roundly critiqued in his own essay on fairy stories some 20 years earlier. He goes on speaking about his experience trying to write this preface. "When striving to say some useful things in a preface, I found it necessary to deal with the term fairy. In the course of this, I tried to give an illustration of fairy and said, this could be put into a short story like this. And then I proceeded in what is a first version of Smith of Wotan Major. There I stopped, realizing that the short story had developed an independent life and should be completed as a thing in itself." In trying to explain fairy, he did the one thing which was his most natural inclination. "Don't tell. Show. You can say all you want about it, but until you reveal it, people will not understand. The vision has to be brought to story. There are some facts that are not open to scholastic dissection. Sometimes only story, only myth, conveys the truth of what one has seen, of what one has understood." And so it was as he tried to talk again about Ferry. Over the next 2 years, he worked to bring final form to Smith the Wotan Major. This was the last story that Tolkien wrote, and it was the last to be published in his lifetime. It is a deceivingly simple tale, and its importance in Tolkien's legacy can be incautiously dismissed. This was Tolkien's last published statement on the journey to which he had given his lifeblood, the exploration of Ferry. He himself called the work an old man's book, already weighted with the presage of bereavement. Certainly it is a true story in Tolkien's own terms, a story about the adventures of men in the perilous realm of Ferry, the realm that holds, to quote Tolkien, the seas and the sun, the moon, the sky, and the earth, and all things that are in it, tree and bird, water and stone, wine and bread, and ourselves, mortal men, when we are enchanted. Yes, it is a true fairy story, but this story cannot be read without reference to Tolkien's own life experience. It stands partnered with Leif by Niggle as a very personal gift of fairy. Indeed, these two personal myths, Leif by Niggle and Smith of Wotan Major, stand as bookends to a critical creative experience in Tolkien's life. Like Leif by Niggle, Smith of Wotan Major is a short story. It can be easily read in an hour or so, and then contemplated for many years. I have time just to read you a little bit. And I will get to Jung, but I did warn you, it's a long lecture. I'm getting there. I haven't seen too many people nodding yet. We're getting there. And so he begins. There was a village once, not very long ago for those with long memories, nor very far away for those with long legs. Wotan Major it was called, because it was larger than Wotan Minor, a few miles away, deep in the trees. But it was not very large, though it was at that time prosperous, and a fair number of folk lived in it, good, bad, and mixed, as usual. It was a remarkable village in this way, being well known in the country round about for the skill of its workers in various crafts, but most of all for its cooking. It had a large kitchen which belonged to the village council, and the master cook was an important person. The cook's house and kitchen adjoined the great hall, the largest and oldest building in the place, and the most beautiful. It was built of good stone and good oak. Though it was no longer painted or gilded, as it had been once upon a time. In the hall, the villagers held their meetings and debates, and their public feasts, their family gatherings. So the cook was kept busy, since for all these occasions he had to provide suitable fare. For the festivals, of which there were many in the course of a year, the fare that was thought suitable was plentiful and rich. There is one festival to which all looked forward, the 24 festival, since that was only held once in 24 years. And only 24 children were invited for that occasion. The master cook was expected to do his best. And in addition to many other good things, it was custom for him to make the great cake. By excellence, or otherwise, of this his name was chiefly remembered, for a master cook seldom, if ever, lasted long enough in office to make a second great cake. There came a time, however, when the reigning master cook, to everyone's surprise, since it had never happened before, suddenly announced that he needed a holiday. And he went away. No one knew where. And when he came back some months later, he seemed rather changed. He had been a kind man and was liked by others, but he was himself serious and said very little. Now, on his return, he was merrier and often said and did the most laughable things. And at feasts, he would sing gay songs, which was not expected of master cooks. Also, he brought back with him an apprentice, and that astonished the village. Now, it was common for the master cook to have an apprentice. In fact, the village had commented that this master cook had put off choosing his apprentice for far too long. The young boy that the master cook had brought back, however, seemed somewhat different and perhaps unsuitable. First of all, well, he was not from Oulton Major. That was clear. And, well, the apprentice was apparently only a very young man, a boy still. As the story developed, it is revealed that Alf, the apprentice that the master cook had brought back, was actually an elf. Alf meaning elf. And had apparently been met on the cook's own journey in Faerie. In fact, Alf was the king of the elves. And he had come to Woten Major with a task. Once in the distant past, Woten, set close to the ancient wood, had been animated by contact with Faerie. The effect of that contact had lingered in the work of its artisans. But those times were now entirely forgotten in the village. Alf had come to bring back the touch of Faerie and to bring the gift of an elven star, a gift that gave calling and passage to one chosen person into the perilous realm of which he was king. One day, a few years after Alf's arrival, the master cook again declared that he had another journey to take, and this time he would not return. Alf remained, initially still as apprentice, and then for many years thereafter himself becoming master cook. And a strange artifact, a tiny silver elfin star, apparently a gift once received by the departed master cook himself, had been left behind with Alf, to be passed along now to another. As was the custom with the great cake, small trinkets were placed therein, usually coins which the children would gleefully find in their slices of cake. And the elfin star was to be placed in the great cake. At the 24-year party, a new child would receive and consume the gift of the elven star in his slice of cake. The gift fell upon a young smith, Smith, son of the village smithy. He consumed it unknowingly. But then, as months passed, something began to happen to him. The feast had been in midwinter, but it was now June, and the night was hardly dark at all. The boy got up before dawn, for he did not wish to sleep. It was his 10th birthday. He looked out of the window, and the world seemed quiet and expectant. A little breeze, cool and fragrant, stirred the waking trees. Then the dawn came, And far away he heard the dawn song of the birds beginning, growing as it came towards him, until it rushed over him, filling all the land round the house, and passing on like a wave of music into the west, as the sun rose above the rim of the world. "It reminds me of Faery," he heard himself say. "But in Faery the people sing too." And then he began to sing, high and clear, in strange words that he seemed to know by heart. And in the moment, the star fell out of his mouth, and he caught it in his open hand. It was bright silver now, glistening in the sunlight, but it quivered and rose a little, as if about to fly away. Without thinking, he clapped his hand to his head, and there the star stayed, in the middle of his forehead, and he wore it for many years after. As he grew, Tolkien continues in the story, from time to time he would go off, sometimes walking, sometimes riding, and it was generally supposed that it was about business. But he had business of his own kind in Faery, and he was welcome there, for the star shone bright on his brow, and he was as safe as a mortal can be in the perilous country. The lesser evils avoided the star, and from the greater evils he was guarded. For that he was grateful, for he soon became wise and understood that the marvels of Faery cannot be approached without danger, and that many of the evils cannot be challenged with weapons of power, too great for any mortal to wield. I should read that. Cannot be challenged but with weapons of power too great for any mortal to wield. The story goes on, and I can't read too much more, although I would like to. As the myth came to Tolkien, as he was writing his preface, it came with a beginning and an end. A beginning of the granting of the star, and an end of the bequeathing of the star to another. Over the next 2 years, as Tolkien finished the story, he filled in the middle. He filled in the events of Smith as he ventured in to the land of Faery. The beginning, the end, they came quickly. To the nature of Faery, the nature of the Faery experienced by Smith, I think he gave some consideration. There are 5 events he tells. 5 short sequences, glimpses of Faery as experienced by Smith, who had received the Fae Star, the passage into the perilous realm. He travels to the Windless Sea, seeking out those distant shores. And there, as he looks upon the sea, a great elven ship comes sailing in and is cast upon the shore. And off the boat there come tall, noble elven warriors, singing songs of victory, returning from battles in the distant west. He cowers on the ground in fear, and they pass over him. Next, he travels long and far. He comes to a vale covered in mist, and there, as the mist clears, in the center of the vale, he sees a great tree. A tree rising story upon story. It is the tree of the king. It radiates brilliant light. And every leaf, every flower upon it is of light. And of yet, and yet different. An image very much like his own image of the tree of tales he had encountered. A third event. Terrifying event. He seeks ever to go deeper into the realm of Faery. he comes to a vale, and there he sees a lake far below. And from an overhang above the lake, he looks and sees that there are glistening lights and forms like aquatic animals of light within. He ventures down to the sea. As he touches upon it, a terrible wind comes up and blows him. He grabs to a tree, attempting to anchor himself, holding the poor birch as it is stripped of all of its leaves. The wind dies down. The birch has been denuded. He feels great gratitude and sorrow for what has happened. He puts out his hand and feels the heart of the birch, which says to him only, "You do not belong here. Go away." And with the tears of the birch upon his hand, he leaves. He says for many years he did not return to Faerie. And then again he went. At last he found a road through the outer mountains, and he went on till he came to the inner mountains, and they were high and sheer and daunting. Yet in the end he found a pass that he could scale. And upon a day of days, greatly daring, he came through a narrow cleft and looked down into the vale of Evermorn, where the green surpasses the green of the meads of Outer Faerie, as they surpass our own in springtime. There the air is so lucid, the eye can see the red tongues of birds as they sing on trees upon the far side of the valley, though that is very wide, and the birds are no greater than wrens. As he set foot upon the grass of the vale, he heard elven voices singing. And on a lawn beside a river bright with lilies, he came upon many maidens dancing. The speed and grace and the ever-changing modes of their movements enchanted him, and he stepped forward towards their ring. Then suddenly they stood still, and a young maiden with flowing hair and kilted skirt came to meet him. She laughed as she spoke to him, saying, "You are becoming bold, Starbrow, are you not? Have you no fear of what the queen might say if she knew of this, unless you have her leave?" He was abashed, for he became aware of his own thought and knew that she read it, that the star on his forehead was a passport to go wherever he wished, and now he knew that it was not. But she smiled as she spoke again, "Come, now that you are here, you shall dance with me." And she took his hand and led him into the ring, and there they danced together. And for a while, he knew what it was to have the swiftness and power and joy to accompany her. But soon, as it seemed, they halted again, and she stooped and took up a white flower from her feet and set it in his hair. "Farewell now," she said. "Maybe we shall meet again by the queen's leave." And so in the Vale of Faerie, he had met the dancing maidens, the elven maidens. He remembered nothing of the journey home from that meeting, until he found himself riding along the roads of his own country. And in some villages, people stared at him in wonder and watched him till he rode out of sight. Tolkien notes that after this, it was many years till he again, Smith, returned to Faerie. But there was one last journey he took. Of course, Tolkien, with this myth, did write an analysis. He wrote a long summary of it. He gave it many years of consideration. In fact, he worked out an entire chronology of the lives and genealogies of every individual mentioned in the myth. And he notes that the last journey taken by Smith occurred when he was 58 years of age. I don't know if this has autobiographical meaning, but it was at that moment that Tolkien had completed The Lord of the Rings at age 58, around 1950. Smith had received a summons, and he made a far journey. Longer, it seemed to him, than any he had yet made. He was guided and guarded, but he had little memory of the ways that he had taken, for often he had been blindfolded by mist or by shadow, until at last he came to a high place under a night sky of innumerable stars. There he was brought before the Queen herself. She wore no crown and had no throne. She stood there in her majesty and her glory, and all about her was a great host, shimmering and glimmering like stars above. But she was taller than the points of their great spears, and upon her head there burned a white flame. She made a sign for him to approach, and trembling he stepped forward. A high, clear trumpet sounded, and behold, they were alone. He stood before her, and he did not kneel in courtesy, for he was dismayed and felt that for one so lowly, all gestures were in vain. At length he looked up and beheld her face, and her eyes bent gravely upon him, and he was troubled and amazed, for in that moment he knew her again, the fair maiden of the green veil, the dancer at whose feet the flowers sprang. She smiled, seeing his memory, and drew towards him. And they spoke long together, for the most part without words. And he learned many things in her thought, some of which gave him joy, others filled him with grief. "But, Lady of Faery," he stammered, "where then is the king?" For he had asked this question many times of the people of Faery, and they had all said the same, "He has not told us." And the queen answered, "If he has not told you, Starbrow, then I may not. But he makes many journeys, and may be met in unlikely places. Now, kneel in your courtesy." Then he knelt, and she stooped and laid her hand on his head. And a great stillness came upon him, and he seemed to be both in the world and in Faery, and also outside of them and surveying them, so that he was at once in bereavement and in ownership and in peace. Then after a while, the stillness passed. He raised his head and stood up. The dawn was in the sky, the stars were pale, and the queen was gone. Far off he heard the echo of a trumpet in the mountains. The high fields where he stood were silent and empty, and he knew that his way now led back to bereavement. I suspect as Tolkien wrote those words, tears were in his eyes. He had met the Queen of Faery. Oh, in his youth, at the beginnings of his venturing, he had known a dancing maiden, and he with her, had danced. But now he realized. At the end of his journeys, he realized who she was. Who it was whom he had met. In some mythologies, she's been called the Lady of Wisdom. In ancient times, men spoke of one whose name was Sophia, Queen. Her name meant wisdom. In ancient texts, she was the one who made men prophets, and she alone. She was the one sought by the philosophers, by the philosophia, the lovers of wisdom. But her wisdom was not of this world. And when it came, it was given as an act of grace alone. On his way home, the queen gave him a message. The message was that if he met the king, he should tell him, "The time has come. The time has come." On the way back to the village, he met Alf on the borders of Faerie. And for the first time, he realized who Alf really was. That Alf the apprentice, Alf the master cook, Alf the one who had placed a fae star in a cake many years before, 48 years before, that Alf was the king of Faerie. Alf told him that the time had come, as had said the queen. It was time for him to give back the gift of the star. Alf explained that the star now would pass to another. His time was done. Oh yes, he could return to the borderlands, the thresholds of Faerie. And certainly he could remember where he had gone. But never could he go deeply into that realm again. It was with sadness that the smith saw it was so. And Alf took him to the small room at the back of the kitchen, to the tabernacle of spices. And he took the star from his forehead, Smith did, and handed it back to Alf. The gift needed to be passed on. This was the last story that Tolkien wrote, the last story that he published. It came to him quickly, in beginnings and end, the gift and return of the Fae Star. The central portions, I think, in some ways reflect his own journey, his own sense of what had been given, of what he had met in that journey. Tolkien developed, as scholar, a sense of the nature of the experience of Faerie. He had noted the importance of a rational approach to the events of Faerie. It was not a dream. It was not a delusion, an hallucination. It was not a pathology. And, importantly, it was not a common experience, but it was experienced across time. In Smith of Wotan Major, Tolkien gives implication that perhaps this fae star only fell once in a generation to an individual. It was a gift of grace given, and he knew that he had received it. He tried to explain. He did indeed, I think, understand the gift. And he ventured in the work of his life to reveal. And so it is that Tolkien found himself knowing the importance of the Silmarillion to an understanding of the Lord of the Rings. In a revelation of my own of sorts, I had a sudden flash of intuition that Tolkien had something more to say to me personally. It came actually suddenly in conjunction with some thoughts about one Carl Gustav Jung, the great Swiss physician, psychologist, and psychiatrist. A crucially important text authored by Jung is about to be published. In October of this year, I am informed, the Red Book, Jung's own imaginal writings, will finally be published. Those interested in Jung have awaited this day for, more than 50 years. So what is this Red Book? Why is it important? Given another hour, I might say much more, and I probably should have given a second lecture just on this subject, but I will just say a few things here. First of all, let me give you a little bit of an introduction to Jung. Carl Gustav Jung was born in 1875 in Switzerland, the son of a family full of Protestant pastors. In his early youth, he had some rather unusual experiences. He had said he had sensed, as a young man, that there was always deep in the background the feeling that something other than myself was involved. It was as though a breath of the great world of stars and endless space had touched me, or as if a spirit had invisibly entered the room, the spirit of one who had long been dead, and yet was perpetually present in the timelessness, until far into the future. Denouements of this sort were wreathed with the halo of a noumen, of a god force. He had had a sense of a reality distant from the common reality. He described these worlds as his number one and his number two. Number two was ageless. It was dwelling in a twilight that he described simply as God's world. Number one was the present self, a Swiss boy, son of a pastor. And yet he knew that two souls dwelt in his breast. He went on to study medicine. While studying for his final examinations, he finally picked up a textbook of psychiatry. At this point in 1900, psychiatry was definitely the poor child of medicine, and he had really given it very little consideration. He read a textbook by Kraft Ebing, where the author described psychoses as diseases of the personality. Diseases of the personality. A light went off in Jung, and he said, "Here alone the two currents of my interest could flow together, and in a united stream, dig their own bed. Here was the empirical field common to biological and spiritual facts, which I had everywhere sought and nowhere found. Here at last was the place where the collision of nature and spirit became reality." The collision of nature and spirit became reality. In December of 1900, he entered the Bergholzi Hospital, a psychiatric institution near Zurich, and there spent the next decade as a resident, living in the insane asylum, spending hours of each day with those there who were patients. In 1906, Jung came to meet Sigmund Freud and had close association with Freud for about 6 years thereafter, from 1906 to about 1912. Though certainly of crucial import, this association was a very brief and early episode in a career spanning 60 years. It was perhaps most important in the negative definition. Jung discovered a multidimensional nature residing in the soul, a dimensionality that Freud simply rejected. To Freud, the contents of the unconscious, the deeper reality we encountered, all had been placed there from exterior perception. It was a basement, and it was a basement filled with our repressed clutter. Clutter collected, forgotten, denied from our traumas of potty training and parental fixations. There was no eternal spirit. And that was in complete contradistinction to the attitude of Carl Gustav Jung. He had felt something more. He had felt the borderlands of, shall we say, fairy from a very early age. Now, over decades, Tolkien has received Jungian interpretations. And at this particular point in time, I think it's really critical that Jung receive a Tolkienian analysis. I think it might really turn things on their head and open people to some new consideration of something that they think they understand. Because when we think we understand things too thoroughly, well, it's time to think again. Jung, in his work at the Bergholzi, came to witness that mythic elements emerged in psychoses. And Jung turned to a study of mythology in an attempt to understand this. Of course, this fascination, this interest, led to his break with Freud around 1912. And that was a crucial moment for Jung, a moment of his own reconsideration. Jung was at that time 37 years of age. His professional world pretty much dissolved around him, and many of his professional associations were severed in his break with Freud. He turned to a reconsideration of everything he knew, and he began to ask an unusual question. He asked himself, what is my myth? What is my myth? He knew that he was not contained within the Christian myth, the common consensus myth. He was not contained within Freud's myth. Did he have a myth, a story? Not in the sense of a story he possessed, but in a sense of a story that possessed him. Was there a myth in which he lived? Around the beginnings of the Great War, at precisely the time Tolkien was beginning his explorations of the realm of faerie, in these same years in Switzerland, Jung was beginning a similar journey. As he sat at his desk one day, he felt the intense need to simply let go, to see what it was across the borderland that was calling him, that was bidding his attention. And so he says he simply closed his eyes. And he felt himself drop to some great depth into a realm different from the daylight realm, an imaginal realm, a land of faerie, we might say, in Tolkienian analysis. In one of these explorations, he found himself falling what seemed an infinite distance until his feet stuck a muddy earth. He looked around, and there was a withered old dwarf leading him into a cave. In the cave, there was a jewel in a setting in the wall. He reached up, picked up the jewel, looked in, and there was a river and a dead body of a hero was flowing by. And then out of the hole, blood came spurting up, and he attempted to tap it with the jewel, and it would not stop. And the journey ended. Another time he found himself in that deep realm, having fallen some great distance. And there before him was an old man. He announced that he was Elijah. And even More startling, there was a young woman with him. She was blind, and her name was Salome. And Salome had a great big snake. The snake seemed somewhat interested in you. It came crawling up over to him. And as he related in his dream seminars in the 1920s, the snake actually coiled itself around his body and up over his head. And he felt himself transformed in the image of a lion-headed deity whose name was Aeon in ancient mythologies. And the vision ended. The perilous realm. Between 1914 and about 1920, Jung intensely investigated, pursued, ventured within this imaginal realm. And he also felt that he had to record what he was seeing, record the events of his visions. And so he did. He kept 5 little black books. And eventually, as the process advanced, he felt the need to produce a single large volume, which he called the Red Book. And in the Red Book, he put his fantasies in form. They came in a rather hieratic, holy language. He says of this period, an incessant stream of fantasies had been released. And I did my best not to lose my head, but to find some way to understand these strange things. I stood helpless before an alien world. Everything in it seemed difficult and incomprehensible. I was living in a constant state of tension. Often I felt as if a gigantic block of stone was tumbling down upon me. From the beginning, there was no doubt in my mind that I must find the meaning of what I was experiencing in these fantasies. He goes on, I wrote down the fantasies as well as I could and made an earnest effort to analyze the psychic conditions under which they had arisen. Archetypes speak the style of high rhetoric, but since I did not know what was going on, I had no choice but to write everything down in the style selected by the unconscious itself. Sometimes it was as if I were hearing it with my ears, sometimes feeling it with my mouth, as if my tongue were formulating words. And now and then, I heard myself whispering aloud. During this period, one particular fantasy image appeared to him. He came with name, and his name was Philemon. Jung described him as a figure of a Greco-Alexandrian nature. He had horns and blue kingfisher wings. And he carried a ring of keys. On his lunch breaks, Jung would go to his garden during this period and walk with Philemon. And he felt that Philemon was his teacher, perhaps in a way like, Rumil, the old philologist, had been a teacher in kind to Tolkien. An event that was happening about the same period in England, in Oxford. Of Philemon, Jung wrote, Philemon and other figures of my fantasies brought home to me the crucial insight that there are things in the psyche which I do not produce, but which produce themselves and have their own life. Philemon represented a force which was not myself. In my fantasies, I held conversations with him. And he said things which I had not consciously thought. For I observed clearly that it was he who spoke, not I. He said I treated thoughts as if I generated them myself. But in his view, thoughts were like animals in the forest, or people in a room, or birds in the air. And he added, if you should see people in a room, you would not think that you had made those people, or that you were responsible for them. He confronted me in an objective manner, and I understood that there is something in me which can say things I do not know and do not intend. I do not know and do not intend. Now, how does an individual deal with an experience like this? Here we have Jung, 37, 38, 40 years of age, walking in his garden with Philemon, keeping a journal of fantasies. And this journal is beautiful. It's illustrated. The book looks like a medieval manuscript, and it is full of these fantasies. So how does one deal with this? One can assume that he is insane, and I'm sure this thought crossed Jung's mind, as it did Tolkien's. Jung also looked at the possibility that he was really an artist, that this was an artistic creation, and that he was a painter, that he was a writer. There was a voice that kept coming to him, telling him, "You are an artist." And one could approach such an experience, proclaiming oneself a prophet. I am a prophet, receiving a revelation. In end, and with some struggle, Jung rejected these three options. He was not insane. He was not an artist. And he was not a prophet. He was a physician. He was a scientist. He was a scholar. One might also say he was a philologist, a lover of word. And what was his duty to the experience? To experience and understand, to explain and to reveal. In later years of his life, Jung built himself a sanctuary in a place called Bollingen on the shores of Lake Zurich. It's actually a place I once had the opportunity of visiting some 20 or more years ago. He called it his tower. There he went for his sacred moments. In the tower, there is a great and beautiful picture of Philemon as he knew him, a picture that appears in almost like form in the Red Book. And over the gates of the tower, he had carved in the stone these words: "Philemonis sacrum, Fausti poenitentia." In Latin, "Shrine of Philemon, repentance of Faust." Shrine of Philemon, repentance of Faust. What was Faust's repentance? Jung felt a deep connection to the author of Faust, Goethe. And in the story of Faust, there's an episode where Faust wishes to reclaim to the greater development of society land held by an old couple. The name of the couple, Philemon and Baucis. This old couple had kept an inn, and it was to be raised in the greater progress forwarded by Faust. Philemon and Baucis had kept an inn, and in this inn they had received the visit of the gods. This was the place where Hermes had come, where earth and heaven had touched, and these innkeepers had received them. They had been mediators in the communication of above and below. But Faust, in his progress, would raise that sacred land and kill these old keepers of a sacred place of meeting between above and below. And so Jung took that sin of Faust very personally. Shrine of Philemon. Repentance of Faust. Jung sought throughout his life to create a place, again, of intersection between above and below. He was quite interested in hermeneutics, in the interpretation of texts. He had undergone an experience that we might, in Tolkienian terms, call a venture into the realm of fairy. He called it active imagination, and he called the realm of archetypes. In later years, he wrote, "Today I can say that I have never lost touch with my initial experiences. All my works, all my creative activity has come from those initial fantasies and dreams which began in 1912, almost 50 years ago. Everything that I accomplished in later life was already contained in them, although at first only in form of emotions and images, in form of fantasies, of stories. It has taken me virtually 45 years to distill within the vessel of my scientific work the things I experienced and wrote down at that time. As a young man, my goal had been to accomplish something in my science. But then I hit upon this stream of lava, and the heat of its fire reshaped my life. That was the primal stuff which compelled me to work upon it. My works are a more or less successful endeavor to incorporate this incandescent material into the contemporary picture of the world." Okay. In October of this year, Jung's Red Book, the book that was hidden for many years, will be published. And why was it hidden? Well, it's hard to get Blue Cross and Blue Shield to pay for a therapeutic visit to a mystic, or alternatively, a physician or therapist who is the disciple of a proclaimed mystic or visionary or imaginative author. There's a problem there. It's been a problem in Jungian studies, in Jungian therapy, for the last 50, 60, and more years. Jung was a scientist, as he proclaimed again and again throughout his life and throughout his writings. He was an empiricist, but to a degree, his science, his empiricism, was directed to the most extraordinary human experience, an experience of otherness, an experience of transcendence, an experience that in Tolkienian analysis might be called a venture into the realm of fairy. And so now we'll have the book. There will be many discussions of it, of its sources, of its influences in German Romantic literature or this or that philosophical statement, of the very many sources Jung was familiar with. Hopefully, as we approach that great work forthcoming, we will keep in mind the experience of one Ronald Reuel Tolkien in those same years, and of his work, his philological investigations. And perhaps in that topsy-turvy comparison, some truth, some understanding may come. And so I thank you very much for your tolerance of this long lecture.